We have one matter for hearing this morning. Before we begin, let me introduce the panel. My name is Wade Birdwell, Associate Justice here. To my left is Judge Ruben Gonzalez of the 432nd. And you know how I remember his numbers? Because mine used to be the 342nd.
Good morning.
Good morning. And our newest member of the court here to my right, the rookie, is D. Michael Wallach, Justice Wallach. So I understand we've got some splitting of the arguments, and I am not going to be very good at trying to figure out who's doing all of that. I'm going to let you do all of that. So if everybody's fine, if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
May it please the court, Mr. Kyle Funville, the Audit Public Appellant, Mr. Craig Haynes, the Audit First for 10 minutes for the Appellee, Ms. Karen Casella, the Audit Second for 5 minutes for the Appellee.
All righty.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Sure.
In this court's recent Bluestone opinion, that was just released in April of this year, Justice Basil was able to capture, I think, some of the frustration that a lot of landowners...
Oh, so that was Justice Basil. Okay.
Yes. Is able to capture a lot of the frustration that a lot of the landowners in Texas feel when he said that because of the nuances in allocating post-production cost, there is sometimes a day-as-night feeling when you're interpreting the royalty clause. And I believe what he was alluding to is that when the parties rely solely on, to use his words, industry jargon and outdated legalese to have this battle of who pays production cost, there is a very real risk that somebody's going to be upset. This lease is not one of the night as day leases. The lease, it does have some of the oil and gas lingo, the traditional oil and gas lingo, but on the issue of post-production cost, it is clear, it makes sense, and it can and should be interpreted as it's written. And so I want to walk through some of the relevant, we don't have time to go through probably every provision, but the relevant language I've included in tab one.
Let me ask a question here. Yeah, you start out with the fact that, at least by location, it is a wellhead sale,
okay,
and that doesn't seem to be disputed. You talk about market value, which gets us back into Heritage and the progeny from Heritage, even though you had the language about Heritage here. It says the market value used in the calculation of all royalty under this lease shall never be less than the total proceeds received by lessee. Okay, then you come down to a few more sentences later. If lessee realizes proceeds of production after deduction. So here are my two questions. Number one, is there a difference between receives and realizes, and what is the impact of the word realizes in the second proviso?
I would submit that there is no difference. Realizing it would, under this lease, be the same as received. And I think the court is right that the total proceeds received by lessee, at least under the appellant's interpretation of it, is, in lack of a better term, a defined term that includes adding back in any of the post-production costs that were deducted prior to the lessee realizing proceeds of production.
Well, if somebody receives, I understand what that means, okay? It means you write me a check or transfer money into my account or whatever, but realizes can have a broader concept than receiving. And so how do you perceive the definite, what is your perception of what when someone realizes proceeds?
Well, my perception of realizing proceeds is this is the actual price that is received. and according to...
Price is a different terminology.
And that, that's a very good point, and I don't want to mix the two prematurely, but the proceeds are the actual proceeds received under the gas sale and purchase contract. That is the definition of realized. Now, how you get there, the lessees have told us how you get there and how it's calculated. And it's calculated based on the WASP after deduction of these post-production costs. But the position that the lessees have taken throughout the trial court level is that is their actual proceeds. That is the amount, this netted out proceeds that they realize at the end of the day. So I think I understand the court's question and the fact that there's a difference between realized or a potential difference between realized and received, but the way that it's been presented to the landowner, the royalty owners throughout the trial level is the price that they realize, the lessee realizes, is the netted out price.
Is there a difference in the, I didn't see any briefing on that issue. So is there any difference in the case law between realizing proceeds and receiving proceeds?
To be honest, I have not looked at that specific term. I would be more than happy to brief the court on that difference. And we kind of skipped around, but it's a good point.
I apologize. I distracted you.
No. It is very good discussion because you pointed out what I was going to say, which is the first two sentences are clear. It's a market value at the rail lease. If the lease stopped at those first two sentences, the gas is sold at the rail. We don't dispute that. We also don't dispute...
Well, there's no dispute that the proceeds themselves are the amount paid. Is the amount paid, correct?
The proceeds are the amount...
The use of the word proceeds is funds and the use of the... in the context of received, okay, that's the amount that they actually got in payment of for the gas at the wellhead.
Yes, there's no dispute that the lessee paid a royalty on its actual proceeds, the actual proceeds that it realized or received at the wellhead. That is not in dispute.
So really the only question is does the add back by using the word realize effectively move the point of sale downstream by requiring the deduction of post-production amounts, costs?
No, I do not believe that's the question. I don't believe, if you look at the analysis and the reasoning behind an add-back, a backstop provision, as discussed by this court in the Bluestone decision, when you're talking about resolving the disparity between market value and actual proceeds, which could be greater than market value or less, the backstop resolves that disparity by saying, go through your market value analysis, and if that price is greater or less than the proceeds, you pay royalty on, it could say you pay royalty on the proceeds. And if that's the case, if you're applying the backstop, as all these courts have applied it, point of valuation is irrelevant at that point. It is, you agree to a price, and I think there's an example, there's an example in the Westport case that the court discusses in Bluestone, and they actually agree it's the floor price is $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet. So they've contractually set the floor or the backstop price, and if we were to apply that backstop, the $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet, we don't ask where the point of valuation is. That is the price. And that's what the parties in this lease decided to do. They said, go through your market value analysis. It's market value at the point of sale. But that price can never be less than the total proceeds received by lessee, which has to include the post-production costs that are added back in pursuant to the add-back clause. So the point is the parties used a backstop provision And these backstop provisions have been around for a long time. And when the courts talk about the backstop provisions, they give the backstop, just like this court did, they give the backstop its plain, ordinary meaning and effect. And I haven't found a case that supports the argument that's being made by the lessee in this case to say the backstop is something we can ignore. The backstop would be surplusage under Heritage. And in fact, that type of argument, the argument that once you state market value at the well, you can never change, you can never shift the burden of post-production costs back on the lessee, that exact argument was rejected as well by this court in Bluestone, and it was the baked-in argument that once you put market value at the well in the lease, somebody has to go physically remove that, and that's the only way you get around this traditional rule under a market value at the well lease, which is that the lessors pay post-production costs. The court said that there is no logical reason to give to make the at-the-well measure, once stated, unalterable if it is contrary to other controlling provisions. So the idea that at-the-well, the point of valuation, would trump every other lease provision has already been dismissed as a losing argument by this court. But I'll go further than that because I think Justice Owen, in her concurring opinion in Heritage, actually shows us exactly the analysis that the appellants are asking this court to do today. Because what she does, she says clearly that there are any number of ways the parties could have provided that the lessee was to bear all cost of marking the gas. And then she gives two examples. One of them, I believe, applies here. And she says, if the parties had intended that in addition to, and she emphasizes this, in addition to the payment of market value at the well, the lessee would also pay post-production costs, they could have said so. But her analysis is key. And I'm getting to the point. Her analysis aligns with what the court did in this court did in Bluestone, because she recognizes, okay, the initial benchmark under that lease was market value at the well, or at least market value, and ultimately determined to be at the well. But she didn't stop there. She went on to search for any direct statement that would show that the parties to that lease contracted for something in addition to market value at the well. And so she performed that analysis. Now, in that case, she didn't find the direct statement that she was searching out. And so her conclusion was it's a market value at the well. That's the analysis I believe the court did in Bluestone, and that's the analysis it should do in this case. It should acknowledge the initial benchmark is market value at the well because of the location of the sale. But it should go further and say, but did these parties contract for something in addition to market value at the well? And that's where the backstop comes in. And the backstop has to be read in conjunction with the add-back provision. I do want to talk, and if you'll turn to tab 2 of the exhibit binder, I've got two scenarios. One is reality. One is exactly what has happened with the gas in this case, as has been told to us by the lessee. The other is an alternative. So I want to talk first about the wellhead sale. The lessee sells it to marketing, which, again, two different entities. We're not arguing sham transaction, alter ego, any of those things that they say we're arguing. My clients have never taken that position, because when we go through this, I'll show you it's actually hurts them, the fact that they're selling it and having somebody else deduct it. So sells it to marketing. Marketing takes it down and sells it to the non-affiliate. Now, keep in mind, this gray line here, post-production costs are being incurred, but they're not being deducted yet because there's no proceeds to deduct from. So the sale to the non-affiliate happens.
How does the lessee incur post-production costs?
Well, the lessee,
if it sells raw gas at the wellhead, how does it incur post-production costs.
It does, and I'm sorry if I mixed those two. I meant to say post-production costs are being incurred. In this case, under the facts of our case, they are being incurred by the marketing company. They're not being deducted because you don't have anything to deduct them from. So the non-affiliate part, the third party who buys it downstream, will pay proceeds, gross proceeds, before any deduction of post-production costs. Then what happens is marketing takes that and says, well, I incurred X amount in post-production cost. I'm going to deduct these costs from that proceeds, and I'll turn around and sell it to the lessee. If you match this graph, realizing proceeds of production after the deduction, after marketing makes a deduction for the post-production costs, it lines up nearly perfectly with the add-back clause. And I just say nearly because I did not brief the realize issue, and I will do that for the court. Compare that, and so I think it's on all fours, and I think this situation where there's a railhead sale, especially to the affiliate who tells us exactly how they calculate it, I think that is what's contemplated with the add-back clause. Let's compare that to a downstream sale. Let's say that the lessee took on the burden to market the gas itself, which it has the option to do. Again, in that case, the lessee would be incurring costs, but again, there's nothing to deduct the cost from until a third party pays for the gas. But here's what happens with the money in that situation. The third party is paying proceeds before the deduction, so the proceeds are received. I'm out of time, but I thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Craig Haynes for the Chesapeake defendants. A couple of initial things. This is, court probably realizes, one of the numerous cases out of the Judge Womack MDL. She examined many of these leases. And as my opponent mentioned, the invitation in their opening brief to sort of ignore the very specialized rules of construction for these oil and gas leases, I think, is excluded by not just Texas law, but the Bluestone case. The night is day quote is probably the best. I don't think it's criticizing the law. I think it's realizing that you need to apply these rules. You can't take the invitation the plaintiffs had to just sort of read this without the backdrop of Heritage and its progeny in these other cases. And it's Bluestone essentially sort of a treatise on how you analyze these oil and gas clauses. And it says, first, you get the yardstick. What is the valuation method? And secondly, what is the location? Well, in this lease, the yardstick is market value with a floor of, quote, total proceeds received by lessee. And the location, as has been admitted, is at the wellhead. And I would note, as they say both in their summary judgment motion and in their brief, that before they executed this lease, although this is a little bit of color, they knew that the lessees planned to sell to affiliates at the wellhead. So they knew all of this when they entered into the lease. Now, as the court noted, there's no claim here that there's not a sale at the wellhead. There's no claim, incidentally, that they are selling below market. There's no market value survey or something. And there's also, as Justice Birdwell pointed out, there's actually no claim that they are not paying royalty on the total proceeds the lessees actually receive. So what the case turns on is they want to be paid higher, a royalty on something higher than what the lessees receive. And what that higher is the add-back clause. And what that consists of is gathering and transportation costs paid by the purchaser of their lessee, not their lessee itself. And as the court has probably noted, there's no affiliate clauses in this lease or anything like that saying that you get what the affiliate has. They have no lease with the affiliate. And one of the things I want to make
clear.
This
still comes back to what the term realizes means.
Well, it does, but the.
Does realize mean that the party receiving the proceeds, okay, realizes proceeds based upon the deduction of costs, post-production costs incurred by the party receiving,
right?
Okay, in which case post-production costs were not incurred
Exactly.
By Chesapeake here or by total.
Right.
Or, since the language only uses the word realize and doesn't say that it's limited to costs incurred by the party receiving, since it's clear that the actual calculation of the amount received did include the deduction of post-production costs, does that contemplate adding back on the incurred cost, the costs incurred by the marketing?
Right. My answer,
by the purchaser.
My answer to that and my interpretation of that sentence is that when it says, and of course these are at tab 2, and the second page of tab 2 is a little excerpt we have from that, it's the add back clause at the top. If lessee realizes proceeds of production after deduction for expenses, it then has the laundry list, then the proportionate part of such deduction shall be added to the total proceeds received by the lessee. My interpretation of that, both logically and grammatically, and realizing the word uses realize one place and receive the other, is that this is not talking about deductions by the purchaser. This is talking about deductions by the lessee. So they receive money, but they realize a net, and this would apply in a situation where they are selling downstream. So the lessee is not selling at the wellhead. The lessee is selling downstream. They are deducting costs, and so they receive money, and then they realize a net. And they're saying, if you do that, then this add-back applies. That's my interpretation of it. It doesn't apply here. Because
well, the wellhead, the only net would be subtracting cost for production.
That's right, and they don't charge them with production costs. So there isn't anything that they're deducting. There's no post-production costs being deducted by the lessee. The other thing that's very important here.
A question on that.
Yes.
What it says is if lessee realizes, which I think is going to be an interesting discussion, if lessee realizes proceeds of production after deduction, it doesn't say by whom or when, it's just after deduction. So if the lessee gets a check, okay, and that check is after deduction by somebody, why does that not fit the affiliate transaction that we have in this case?
My belief is grammatically it's talking about realizing something and then adding that back to total proceeds received, so it's talking about two different places. And the second response I have to that, the sort of logical reason, is this isn't limited to affiliate sales. There's nothing that says this isn't third party. So logically, if that were the interpretation, and you're supposed to interpret contracts reasonably, if we sold our gas at the wellhead to Exxon, we would have to go try to add back Exxon's pipeline costs and Exxon's gathering costs, which we would have no idea what they are or any way to find out. So that's my interpretation of it. Now, I don't think we need to win that argument to win this case for the reasons I'll state, but that's what I think it means. And the other thing that's very important in light of the reply brief here is that, remember, the floor royalty is on, quote, total proceeds received by lessee. That is not the same thing as the add back, because this says the add-back amounts shall be added to the total proceeds received by lessee. So it is not part of the add-back. It is not part of the total proceeds. It is something else. It's another bucket that they want. Now,
what's the point then?
Well, this, if you're asking how could this ever apply or how could the clause ever apply?
I mean, that's exactly what's the point. If it cannot, by using the word total proceeds received by the lessee, and by the add back saying it's added to total proceeds.
Right.
Okay. You're suggesting that total proceeds plus amount added equals what?
Well,
I mean, the implication here is that total proceeds will be recalculated based upon the deduction.
Well,
the amounts deducted.
I don't think so. I think that the royalty clause says that they get. Well, the floor is total proceeds received by lessee, and then this is an additive amount. This doesn't really apply to the facts of this case because of the wellhead sale.
I'm not sure it applies to anything in the lease if in fact it's been put in there that there's some total that's not named because it's not total proceeds. It's total proceeds plus,
well,
and that total proceeds plus term is never used in the lease,
well,
or particularly in the royalty clause.
Well, it could apply if there's a downstream sale. If there were a downstream sale, the total proceeds would be that received at the point of sale. If the lessee had paid costs, then presumably you would trigger this clause. You'd still have to look further, but presumably it would have some meaning. But the floor here talks about the floor is based on the total proceeds received by lessee. And this is saying the add back is something different than that.
So the royalty clause does not limit the point of sale to the wellhead.
It does not.
Why would it not? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to
interrupt. I'm finished.
Why would this add back provision, it says the market value used shall never be less than the total proceeds received by the lessee. And it says you have the add back to the total proceeds received for purposes of this paragraph. What does for purposes of this paragraph mean?
Well, again, I think that is talking about a situation where there's a downstream sale and there are costs paid by the lessee in getting to that downstream point. So the total proceeds they receive would be from the buyer at the downstream point. That's talking about adding back the interim costs that the lessee paid. I think that's what that's talking about. Now, there's a couple other reasons here in addition to this that the summary judgment should be affirmed. Of course, there is the Heritage line of cases, which the court's familiar with. And in this case, on these facts, this lease is not necessarily, it's a point of sale lease, but it's undisputed the point of sale here on these facts is the wellhead. So under Heritage and its progeny, you do not, as the Bluestone case said, you don't change the royalty obligation by adding back, by a disallowance or an add back of post-production cost to something because now you're valuing it somewhere else. In Heritage, for example, they negotiate a lease that says you won't deduct transportation. The lessee took it downstream and deducted transportation, and the lessee won that case because they said if you value it at the wellhead, then you cannot have a situation where you say you're going to value it downstream and not deduct transportation. Saying you're going to add back transportation to a wellhead value is the same thing as saying you're not going to deduct it from a downstream value. So Heritage, Burlington completely control this. Secondly, I wanted to mention the other provision that says, however, in no event shall they receive a price that is more than the price received by the lessee. Now, this is a pricing claim. They have this chart and this argument that seems to say we're saying total proceeds and price is always synonymous. That's not necessarily true. You could have a volume claim, say that you didn't pay us on certain volumes at the price that you received for those volumes. That doesn't violate the clause, but this one does. I see my red lights up, but what they are saying is we got paid royalty on these volumes at $1. We wanted it $2, and that direct and to grant that directly violates that clause in the lease.
Thank you, counsel. You'll add 1 minute to appellant, please.
May it please the court, Karen Priscilla for Total. I'd like to discuss a different reason than what we've been talking about, which is
Total?
Pardon me?
Is that how it's pronounced? Is Total?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
I'd like to discuss a second reason to affirm the trial court summary judgment. And it's based on a different clause, and it's the value enhancement clause. And how do you get to the value enhancement clause? What they are doing to get where they want to be, to get what they're really trying to do is get a higher royalty than at the well. They want it on the downstream sale. And so how they get there is they go to the add back, and in the add back, and this is tab 2 of your handout, you can see that what's added back is to the lessees for purposes of this paragraph. And if you look at the total proceeds paragraph, that also is to the lessee. So what they want to do is say the lessee also includes the purchaser. And once you do that, it means that for the market, the value enhancement clause as well. So when you look at the value enhancement clause, you need to look at number 5 and 6 in the handout that you have. And clearly the first one refers to cost. You can't deduct cost to transform the gas into marketable form. And then if you look at the next one, which is number 6, it's referring to enhancing the value of the gas. And there's 3 requirements, which I've numbered as A, B, and C there. You have to enhance the value of the marketable gas and to receive a better price. And neither of those are disputed. So then you get to the third requirement, and it's only the actual costs that can be deducted. And here, it's really not disputed that the only cost considered is the actual cost of post-production costs reduced out of the downstream price when doing the net back. So in that case, you would have a value enhancement, and you would deduct those costs. Now, they want to argue, when they argue on the one side, they're saying that you consider the purchaser's price. But when you get to this clause, they say, wait a minute, it says actual costs. It has to be your actual costs. So they want it to be treated differently on one side than the other. But they really can't have it both ways. Either the lessees owe royalties on the price that they get, or if you're going to do the other provision, then you can deduct the enhancing post-production costs from the downstream proceeds on which they want a royalty. But either way, they've been paid properly under the lease. So to overcome this inconsistent use of actual costs or who's the purchaser and who's the lessee, they argue that the cost under the transform to marketable form is the only cost you can consider in the second clause.
Well, question about that is, under the add back, it's not limited to enhancing the value for marketable oil. That language doesn't exist there.
No, I agree, Your Honor. What I'm saying is you have to treat the lessee term the same under all the provisions. To use lessee meaning one thing in the total proceeds in the add back and consider it differently in the market or the value enhancement clause is not proper. You can't have it both ways.
Well, what I'm saying is, though, that what they get to add back or what they don't get to count is different in the add back clause and the clause right before that. The into marketable form is used in the first but not the second. So which, you know, how do you
Well, the add back is for the post production costs.
Right.
And then what the enhancement does is that adds them back, and the enhancement piece deducts them if they're enhancing the value. So it's an add and a minus. That's how those work together. So I do agree with you that the add back is not focusing on the enhancement value. Well, the other argument is it's the same, and the problem with that is
In other words, basically going back to my language of realized and who incurs, you're saying that when reading the value enhancement clause and using the word lessee's actual cost of such enhancements by including enhancements with costs qualifying the term lessee, that in fact, that's basically saying the lessee's incurring the marketing costs, the post-production costs.
Well, under their version, that's how they're treating them, yes.
Why can't you read this in terms of the value-enhancing sentences, because we don't have clauses here, as being a situation where the lessee were to take and do the marketing itself as opposed to the add-back clause, which is a sale to a third party affiliated or unaffiliated, which assumes those costs and they get added back that way.
Well, but I think the point is, the way they're construing the lease, they are saying that it's in effect, by including what the purchaser does, then we are doing that. It really is adding in that to us under the add back. So then you get to go back.
I would agree if that's the interpretation, but
well, I don't agree that's interpretation. But that
no, that's what they're saying. I understand that. My point is, though, in terms of the structure of this paragraph, because it seems to bounce back and forth to various anticipated relationships, it's hard to follow. So to say that it's unambiguous is an interesting statement. But go ahead.
Well, the add-back really is, like I said, the post-production costs. If you're, like Mr. Haynes said, if you're selling downstream, then you would have post-production costs. But the point here is that they're treating them differently than what the situation is, which is a market value at the well, no deductions being made, and my time is up. So.
Briefly, Your Honors, Heritage and its progeny did not include backstops, and they did not include the add stop, and for or the add back. I apologize, and for that matter, they also did not include the type of cost-free language that we have in the lease, and it did not include a Heritage disclaimer. So, to say that I think Heritage guides
As with every other case on royalty, oil and gas royalty construction, but I don't think any of the cases control, and I don't think they can control, because I don't think that the court has considered a backstop when you define total proceeds to include post-production costs. Second point I want to make is, again, this idea that we superimpose the point of valuation onto the backstop, based on my interpretation of Bluestone, was rejected. They had a pure proceeds lease in the addendum, and the oil company tried to argue, well, it doesn't say point of valuation, so we'll just use the point of valuation in the printed lease form and superimpose that into the proceeds, and Burlington says no post-production costs, or post-production costs are borne by the lessee. And this court says, no, you can't do that. It doesn't require super clarity to disavow this point of valuation. And so the backstop, using total proceeds received by lessee as the benchmark, the floor or the backstop benchmark, gets us out of point of valuation. The value enhancement, there is admission after admission after admission that the costs were not incurred by lessee because the sale and title to the gas transfers at the well. I don't believe we're taking an inconsistent position. I do think the who matters when you're talking about the value enhancement because it's tied to lessee's actual cost, but the who, as Justice Wallet pointed out, is not defined when you're dealing with the add-back. Any post-production costs that are deducted by any party has to be added back to the total proceeds for purposes of the royalty paragraph. And the last point I want to make is we did very specific discovery. I mean, this was a summary judgment, so it's not like we had a trial on this, but there was very specific discovery and there was very specific admissions. This isn't a situation where Exxon is buying the gas at the well and we have to go guess at how they calculate the price. The way they calculated the price is 100% crystal clear in this case, and there is statement after statement that the way they calculated, and I would argue that the proceeds they realized are the downstream price, Chesapeake says less marketing's proportionate share of the actual cost, Total says minus the marketing company's cost to move the gas. Either way, you're receiving proceeds, you're receiving a price, realizing proceeds after a deduction. And if you compare these statements, admissions by the lessee on how the gas purchase price is calculated to the case law that was out there at the time this lease was negotiated and drafted, you'll see, and Burlington just put its own, the court's own definition on that, and says when a royalty payment is based on a downstream sales price, the value added by post-production costs must be subtracted from the sales price or otherwise accounted for. And so that is the netback situation that these parties to this lease were trying to get around, and the way that they chose to get around it was put a backstop in place because those are enforced, and define the benchmark, define the floor benchmark that market value can never go below. And for that reason, I believe our clients established a breach of the lease on summary judgment, and we're entitled to a summary judgment, so we're asking the court to reverse the trial court summary judgments, render judgment on liability for my clients, and remand for a trial on damages.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I will. Given the fact that we have sprung on y'all the realize-receive dichotomy, we would ask that y'all address that in post-submission briefs to the court. We'll grant y'all leave to do that. We need to put a, say, the next 2 weeks from appellant with response 2 weeks thereafter, and then we'll, so the case is submitted pending the post-submission briefs, and I think that's it for today.
Thank you.
So, for some of y'all. Some of us, it's not. But anyway, thank y'all so very much. We stand adjourned.
Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned. Good evening.